Some very exciting research is being done at Colorado State University. I'm sitting here with Assistant Professor of Functional Genomics, Stephen Pierce, to talk about wheat and some breakthroughs about a plant you thought you already knew. What are you doing here at CSU to improve the wheat plant?
It's an exciting era for wheat research. We have the information that we need, new genomic tools and databases full of information about the wheat genome to really begin understanding what genes do in the plant. And how, when we change those genes in certain ways, we can make the plant be improved in certain respects. This is something that's been done traditional methods for centuries now. When you think about the beginnings of crop domestications, which happened thousands of years ago, and even earlier generations of breeders, this was essentially done for a lot of human history in like the ignorance of what actually was happening. So you would combine two varieties that look pretty good, and you're looking for an even better variety that comes out of it. This was kind of unfocused, relied on a lot of randomness, and it was kind of an untargeted process. It meant that we had a lot of time to develop these varieties. Now what we have is a full genome sequence of wheat. We have the knowledge in order to start beginning to understand exactly what it is about those plants that means that they act in a certain way. So for now, we're starting to understand when a plant is resistant to a certain disease, we can understand at the genetic level, what's the gene or the gene variant that's different in that plant from the plant that gets the disease. So then we can really target and understand in breeding that when a plant inherits this version of the gene, it's going to be resistant to the disease.
When Norman Borlaug began to breed different kinds of wheat to produce something that was resistant to rust, he was looking at the physical attributes. In this case, you're looking at the genome of the plant.
Yeah, that's right. So taking the Green Revolution as an example. So in the 1960s, they just discovered that DNA was the hereditary basis. And from the work of Mendel earlier in history, you had an idea about how plants were inheriting traits and passing them on from one generation to the other. But at the time when these Green Revolution varieties of plants, which really had a huge impact in agriculture, the process was essentially done blind. So one important trait of the Green Revolution was a semi-dwarfism trait. Plants had shorter stems. It meant they were less able to be knocked over by strong winds and heavy rainfall. And also the plant was putting more energy into the grains rather than wasting on the stems, which was essentially a waste of energy for the farmers. At the time, this came about by crossing a semi-dwarf variety with some of the elite varieties of wheat in the US at the time, and then looking to see which of the ones had the trait that you were interested in doing. What we can do subsequently, and now in kind of the era of molecular biology and genetics, is we can go back and look at what genes were the ones that were making those changes. In retrospect, we can understand that they were selecting for this variant of the gene and understand exactly what it is at the genetic level that makes that stem grow much shorter and so was so beneficial at the time.
What are we attempting to grow in the lab that we'll soon see in the field?
Up to now, we've been able to understand what kind of decisions were made in the past by these growers. Now we have an increasing knowledge of exactly how all of these genes fit together in all of these diverse pathways to really regulate the different aspects, the physiology of the plant, its disease response. So with that understanding comes the ability to, for the first time, to really deliberately manipulate those pathways in ways that we hypothesize are going to be really beneficial for making improved varieties. CRISPR-Cas9 would be one of the most popular methods of genome editing, which is currently the hot topic in agriculture, I would say. And the promise is pretty huge for this technology. The simplest applications we're using right now are that you can target these CRISPR-Cas9 constructs, which is essentially a way of bringing an enzyme which is going to make a double-stranded break in a DNA, very specified point in the genome. So with knowledge of which genes we want to change, we can guide this enzyme to that specific gene in the genome and make a change, like a very small deletion, to break the function of that gene. And then we have the material to compare those plants to see what function that gene had by comparing the plants where the gene is still working and with the plant where we've broken that gene. And in many cases, it may seem surprising, but you can have a lot of beneficial effects from breaking one gene in a plant.
There may be other applications of CRISPR besides Cas9.
That's right. So the basis of the CRISPR-Cas9 system can be thought of almost as like a homing system. It's a way to guide an enzyme, in this case Cas9, to a very specified point on the genome based on similarity with the sequence. What you can then do is you can engineer that Cas9 enzyme, you can replace it with something else so that you can guide a different enzyme to that position if you wanted. One application of that might be if you wanted to localize a certain part of the genome, you can put in a green fluorescent protein, for example. You can guide that protein to that specific point in the chromosome, and then that chromosome will glow up green in the presence of that GFP, so you can kind of tag certain regions of the genome.
CRISPR, wasn't that a bacterial defense against viruses initially?
Yeah, that's right. It was this curious story about how it originally identified. It was a curious system that was found in bacterial systems, and for several decades it was not understood exactly what the bacteria was doing with this. And one thing they realized was that the sequences associated with this CRISPR gene were relating to some of the viruses they were being infected with. So what they realized was this homing mechanism attached to this enzyme, which is going to break open DNA, was this guide system to kind of break down this pathogenic nucleotides that were being injected into the cell. So the way that it works is, as the virus injects its genetic material, the bacteria activates this its own CRISPR-Cas9 system. And so then it knows exactly where to go because it already has the sequence of those viral pathogens. And that's what's guiding the enzyme to these invading pathogens. And that's destroying the DNA before it can replicate itself.
Do you find that the wheat farmers, are they excited about what you're doing?
I think they are. One of the biggest concerns I have is really kind of this breakdown of communication between scientists and the end users, so that would include growers and consumers themselves. I think that they are quite interested by the possibilities. I think until the farmer sees this grain in his hand and can grow it and see that this came about, which wouldn't have been possible any other way, through this genome editing technology, and he can see the true benefits for him and for the product that you're making, or her, then I think that some of that skepticism will remain. I still think sometimes there's a bit of a breakdown, which I think that falls largely on scientists as a whole. We need to do a better job of communicating with non-scientists. I do a lot of teaching in the university and talking among my peers, but for almost all the time we're talking among ourselves, and it's very difficult. You can see the same in political realms, that you're always talking among the same things. It can be difficult to tailor that message and to make sure that everyone else is really understanding and that you're receiving their input. We need to be clear that these are the stakeholders for the science. These are the ones that are providing a lot of the funding for the work that we're doing. Everything we need to do needs to be tailored around their needs and their desires. And so this communication is important. I'd say they're interested and a little curious about it, maybe not completely sold just yet. And I think that that's up to us to be more effective communicators and to really demonstrate the actual product rather than just the potential.
Well, I think that's probably true for any scientific discovery, because even the Green Revolution, there was some hesitancy on the part of farmers in India and other places to adopt the new seed. Getting that communication out helps people realize that it's not something to be feared, but something to be embraced.
I think it certainly has enormous potential beyond even like the original generation of like transgenic GM crops that we're familiar with today.
Corn and soybeans that are main GMO plants.
Yeah, and they account for quite a large majority of the GM crops that are grown in the US. And in fact, there's no transgenic wheat that's been released anywhere in the world. So GM technology has never touched wheat. Guess that it was a little more complicated to work with than these other species. It was more expensive to get the products there, but it's certainly technically possible.
How many base pairs in the wheat's genome?
I think it's about 16 billion.
16 billion. How do you locate the specific gene sequence you wish to alter?
Now that we have a really nice reference that took a lot longer than other species. So, for example, Arabidopsis, which is the simple model plant that's used for a lot of plant research, that was sequenced almost 20 years ago now. So it took a long time for wheat to catch up because of this complexity. But now you have that reference sequence, you can really start to understand which are the genes that are involved in things. Based on their sequence and the similarities to other genes that we know about, you can infer their function. So we know a lot about sequences that do the same jobs in all these other plants based on decades of research. If you find a gene that's almost the same in wheat, a good starting point for your hypothesis is that it's going to do the same job that it does in another plant species. So it doesn't hold for all examples, but you can learn a lot from what's already been done. You're kind of piggybacking off of the research from other people working in different species.
What do you see as the ultimate good that will come out of this research?
Increased yields and quality of wheat products. I think that what genome editing really has the potential to do is to accelerate our progress in breeding and developing novel varieties. But the real potential is it lets you to do things that you wouldn't necessarily have been possible otherwise. So for example, when you're trying to transfer specific disease-resistant genes, all the time when you're looking in plants, what's really important is the genetic diversity. And all across the world, we have these really diverse varieties that look completely different and they have different forms and structures. And that also includes for different disease resistances. So when you're doing traditional breeding, you're kind of relying on the fact that there might be a wild relative or a variety of wheat grown maybe in another country that has that resistance. Then you can transfer that trait across in through conventional breeding into a wheat variety that may be adapted to Colorado. And eventually, through many generations of breeding, you can end up with a wheat variety variety that combines those traits, that it's well adapted to Colorado's environment, but it contains whatever genetic variant it was from that wild wheat that makes it resistant. With genome editing, we're really able to understand exactly what that gene is that makes that plant disease resistant. It's possible to go directly to your Colorado adapted variety, make that specific change that we know is going to make it disease resistant, and you don't need to worry about crossing and combining and making generations and generations of crossing. You can do everything in essentially a single generation. You can otherwise change your well-adapted wheat variety. You only want to change one gene to make it disease resistant. You can input that, and it's just this highly targeted, highly precise, and really rapid progress that you can really make huge impacts in a very short space of time.
It could be disease resistant, drought resistant. Those would be things you could target. Could you make wheat perennial?
Potentially. And so some of these traits are going to be harder than others. So the traits that people are tending to be targeting right now are ones that would be simply to maybe break one gene or to add a to slightly modify one sequence, and that would have a large impact. Those are the simplest traits. There are other ones, for example, perenniality and drought tolerance, that are slightly more complicated.
Over time, interbreeding was the main method for changing the genes of a plant or animal. But the early generation of genetically modified organisms relied on radiation.
So in the case of radiation, and this was a nice example we just covered in my class, we were talking about in the 1960s in the US, radiation was all the rage. There was this Atoms for Peace speech by Eisenhower, and it was very fashionable. Everyone got involved in applying their own radiation to try and see what kind of funky crops they could get just from radiating seeds. And one thing that surprised me and my students was that there's more than 3,000 varieties of plants that have been developed, including modern crops that we're eating right now, that were developed through this radiation breeding. One of the examples that was amazing was the peppermint plant. There was almost all of the peppermint that's grown today was based from this radiation variety. It ended up being resistant to a disease. And so today, everything that you're eating that contains peppermint, so chewing gum, toothpaste, the oil that it's extracted from is from radiation. The use of chemical and radiation was essentially at random to try and see if you could induce that yourself, essentially doing accelerated evolution that would have happened naturally over thousands of years. The main problem with that, although it was effective in some cases, that it's really untargeted. You're having to screen, some cases, thousands of plants to identify that one that might have the change. And even then, there's no guarantee.
And so, it could be lethal, I would think, the radiation to the seed.
In most cases, yes. And so you get a high rate of plants that just won't germinate or that are too sickly to be useful. So the real benefit of CRISPR-Cas9 is we only need to make one gene change. We don't need to screen thousands and just hope by chance that change has happened in one of the plants we're looking at. We can take a single plant and induce the specific change that we're looking at so that we can have the change that we're desiring.
I know you have to get to class. I appreciate Professor Stephen Pierce for taking some time to talk about CRISPR and the exciting work you're doing with the wheat genome.